with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Houck.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, wherever you are in the world at this time. Welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, the show in which encourages you to reclaim that which has always been in you. And I'm very excited to be with you here today, every Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Standard Time. I am Dr. James Houck, and if you would like more information about me or to leave me your comments about today's show, please visit the website at www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity, all one word right there. So it's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. And if you would like to call in and be part of the show, I invite you to. The number is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And these broadcasts are podcasted now in case you want to go back and listen again, or you can go back in the archives and listen to previous shows. And I will be taking your calls in a little while because I really want to hear from you on today's subject. So that the people will live, creating a living dialogue with our ancestors. So that the people will live. Well, I wanted to start off today's show just by wishing everybody a happy mid-October. It's going to be Halloween before we know it, and then it's pretty soon it's going to be November, and then before you know that, we're going to be singing some holiday songs. So, not to rush anybody, but just to keep your calendars handy because time is flying by. So, let us enjoy these last couple of weeks of October. Well, had an interesting last couple of weeks, let's say since we last talked or since last week's show, and something that I've been seeing coming up, not just in the counseling that I do, you know, the counseling therapy that I do with children and teenagers and adults, but also other professional and pastoral professional aspects that I do as well. And it is this. Every now and then, I run into this misperception out there that before you can help others, you have to be free from your own pain and suffering. You know, to first be healed from your own problems, or at least have your act together. And quite often, many people love to quote, on top of this misperception, Jesus' teaching about taking the plank out of your own eye first, before removing the speck of sawdust from another person's eye? Well, quite frankly, this passage is often taken out of context, and many people just wrongly interpret this teaching to mean that others simply have no right to say anything, or people should mind their own business. And this is simply not the case. In fact, it often turns out to be just the opposite. That in spite of themselves, people always find ways to reach out to serve one another. People always find ways to be there for others. People always find ways to want to show compassion. They want to show love. They want to show understanding. And just as I thought about this some more, I went right to this example that let's consider the number of people in our lives who have helped us along the way. You know, they've spoke words of comfort and grace, or maybe they healed us on some level with their kindness and just spontaneity. They just showed up and they were in the right place at the right time. And if we think about this long enough, let's ask ourselves this question. Did these people who were a blessing to us, did these people seem to have their acts together, or did they just do in spite of their perceived limitations? You know, did they wait until they had everything in place before reaching out? Or did it appear that they just reached out and comforted and gifted others? And I'm certain all of us can make a long list of people who fit that description. And that's just the people that we are aware of. What about others who work behind the scenes? You know, people who just very much involved in our lives, yet they weren't, you know, front and center, if we want to call it that. But let's take this idea one step further. Would we be willing to add our names to that list? In other words, do we believe that before we can be of comfort to somebody else or to reach out to others, we must first make sure our, let's say, our front porch is swept clean? Well, not necessarily. And ironically, it's this idea that's often echoed throughout Henry Nouwen's book, The Wounded Healer. It's a very classic book that raises this question. You know, do we have to wait until we are fully healed from our past, our wounds, and our shortcomings? And if the answer is no, then, well, what are we waiting for? You see, we all have psychological, emotional, physical, even spiritual wounds and scars. And these wounds and scars refer to often, you know, what we have gone through. Those reminders of where we have been, how we lived our lives and so forth, and how we've been hurt. But they should not serve as excuses that we make in order to justify our anger or our bitterness or our prejudices. But rather, our woundedness can often serve as a means to awaken compassion and empathy in us towards one another. Now, despite living in the 21st century, there are still huge pockets of people who are considered by society as untouchable and unreachable and therefore unlovable. But who makes these so-called rules? Who sets these boundaries? Who says that we can't go and reach out and be compassionate to this group over here or that group over there? I mean, who sets these boundaries? It's kind of interesting when we look down throughout history that, you know, the people who drew the maps up and they drew lines to partition off boundaries and so forth, it's also has this kind of like a psychological flavor to it, that even though these lines may be drawn on a map to mark these boundaries, it's almost as if people draw lines in our hearts. And we say, well, we can only do so much. We can only go so far. We can only go up to those boundaries. And then after that, that's somebody else's problem. Or, well, on the other side of that boundary, that's where those people live. And therefore, well, you know, we're just not called to reach out to them. We can have sympathy for them, but that's as far as it's going to go. Again, who makes that decision? Who draws those lines on our hearts? Well, one thing, as I have been considering this over the past couple of weeks, I will throw out this one caution that in doing so, we have to be careful that in reaching out to others that we just don't simply act out of our own raw woundedness. Otherwise, we're going to make it about ourselves and what we get out of it instead of focusing on fulfilling the needs in another person. So let's return to the question. No, we do not have to wait until we have our act together before reaching out to another person. There's a fascinating study that I was reminded of last month that I had read years ago, and it involved intercessory prayer. And the researchers just wanted to measure, you know, is there a way in which intercessory prayer has an effect on people? And to what extent does it have an effect on people? And a group of researchers got together, and they had a group of 50 people who were suffering and struggling with some form of cancer, who also believed in the power of prayer. Well, they took these two groups and they separated them. They took this group and they separated them into two groups of 25. And they just talked to them separately. And they said to both groups, you know, and for the next 30 days, and for 25 of them, they were told, just pray for yourselves. Any kind of prayer you want to pray, that's fine, but just pray for yourself. The other group of 25, they were told, now we would like you for the next 30 days to pray for the other 25 people, unbeknownst to them. You know, the two groups didn't talk to each other, so nobody knew what each group was doing. But one group was just told to pray for themselves, and the other group was told to pray for this other group. And after 30 days, they interviewed both groups again, and they discovered that the ones who prayed for themselves didn't necessarily find any changes in their outlook on life. In fact, they were surprised to find that some people were even more miserable than before. But for the group who spent time praying for others, well, they had a more positive outlook on life. They felt better, even though they still struggled with their cancer diagnosis, and they often admitted to being more peaceful and happier. And the implications for this study on intercessory prayer were multiple, including the fact that people can pray for one another and reach out to one another in compassion and provide comfort to others, even if they themselves are struggling with an illness. In other words, we all have giftedness and skills that are not meant for ourselves. We often underestimate ourselves, but when we truly see ourselves as perhaps being an answer to another person's prayer, everything we do then is so that the people will live. And not just live, but live in peace, live in wholeness, live in hope. Recently, Yom Kippur was celebrated on September 27th, just a few weeks back. It was a time of starting over, a clean slate, a newness, a time in which people cried out to God and they sought God's forgiveness and they can go forth with a clean slate. But in talking with many, many people, in walking in a newness of life, they often struggle with, am I doing this correctly? Shouldn't there be more to it? You know, I know I'm forgiven, but how do I live this out? And when do I offer forgiveness and compassion to others? Do I have to wait till I feel like I'm in a good place or a good state in myself before I want to reach out or to pray for somebody? But many people want to live lives of purpose and meaning, but the fear of not knowing how to do this, or perhaps they are so embroiled in the belief that so much of life has already been beaten out of them, or that they've been beaten down, that they struggle to find a reason to care, or let alone get out of bed in the morning. And they find that if I can't simply care for myself, how do you expect me to care for others? Because life has disappointed me. Life has done a dirty trick to me. And they get caught up in just going over and over again in this bitterness, this resentment, this frustration. Well, if you recall the Broadway musical Les Miserables, it was one of the main characters, Fantine, who sang a portion of this sentiment. She sang, I had a dream my life would be so different from this hell I'm living, so different now from what it seemed. Now life has killed the dream in me. Well, finding hope in life has to be one of the major themes that come up in counseling therapy over and over and over again. And I often sit with others who struggle to heal from their past and in their own way and time work through painful memories. But more than just feeling stagnant or stuck in life, people also wrestle with a sense of hopelessness or a feeling that life is meaningless. But the truth is, we're not alone in this life. We all come from a long line of ancestors who are cheering us on, who, if we could hear their voices plainly some days, they would say, hang in there. It's worth it. Keep going. Don't give up. And we have many, many more ancestors who's going to come after us. Again, think about the people who didn't wait until they had their lives healed and sorted out, but rather reached out and healed others regardless. You know, and also someday, you know, future generations will be reminded of us, how we lived our lives and the struggle to remain faithful, to that which we have been called, or how, again, we reached out, how we cared for one another, and so forth. But for all of this and more, do we ever stop to consider the kind of impact our lives have and will have on generations to come? Again, this is one of, I would put it right up there with one of these lessons my teacher taught me that is just very life-changing. Just, flipped me upside down, turned me inside out, and I was never the same again once I fully got this lesson. And I shared with this audience one time that the lesson that my teacher taught me was just by looking at a little cut on the finger I had, just a little bit of blood. And, he just told me to take a good long look at that and, just consider everybody who's has the same blood, everybody who has the same DNA, those who have come before me, thousands and thousands of generations, that they're all in there with us. And he took it one step further with me, and he said, once I was able to see those who have come before me and appreciate those who have come before me, then, he said, you will also be able to see those who come after you, those who are alive but are yet to be born. And he wrapped it up by just saying, they're all in there. They're all in there in that single drop of blood. Well, in creating this living dialogue with one's ancestors, we're going to have to remember that our soul connection with them is not about placing blame or finding fault from wounds suffered from their own trauma or pain. Instead, it's a dialogue intended to create an ongoing opportunity for healing and reconciliation, as well as let's stop the harmful psychological, emotional, and spiritual patterns from being passed on to these generations yet to be born. And many times this requires us to think beyond a simple past, present, future linear approach to our families. And many times I often explain this to people. They like the concept, but they're not quite sure about how to, again, live this out. And I often share that, well, have you ever considered yourself being a transitional or in transformational generation? You know, the ones who you recognize where the problems are, recognize the need for healing, but yet you start the process. You start the process in yourself. You start the process for others. You start the process for the ancestors, and you are definitely committed to keep these psychological, emotional, and spiritual wounds from going any further. And so they really enjoy being the transitional generations. And in fact, it's the kids who really get behind this, especially the teenagers, because they're the ones that are often labeled as the problem in the family. They're the ones that are often labeled as, well, if it wasn't for you, or they're the ones like, you know, I wish you would do better in school, or I wish you would do that. And all the while, the child, the teenager, is just acting out of what's dysfunctional in the family. But being the transitional generation, you know, therefore requires us to stand in the gap, as it were, and offer this healing release, not just for ourselves, but also for all family members, regardless of whether or not, let's say, they were victims of a crime, or they had been wounded, or perhaps they were the ones who committed the crimes. They were the perpetrators, and they acted out of their woundedness. For example, I have friends who actually do this quite well. They set their intention to heal, the intergenerational trauma from the perspective of the unborn generations, much like going back seven generations to heal souls that are stuck due to trauma. They place themselves in the role or the voice of seven generations in the future. And let's begin with an example. Let's say a person was born in 1980, just for the sake of argument. Okay, the effect of healing their intergenerational trauma would then impact generations up to approximately the year 2145. I know it doesn't seem that long, far away, but that's approximately seven generations into the future. Okay, and from this perspective, the need of healing intergenerational trauma now is crucial if the next seven generations are to be empowered to begin their life on Earth free from any traumatic baggage and needless family suffering. So this first generation, let's say, born in 1980, the second generation would be 2005 with their children. The third generation would be 2045, the grandchildren. The fourth generation would be 2070, or great-grandchildren. The fifth generation is 2095, great-great-grandchildren, and so on, until the seventh generation is 2145. And that is going to outlive all of us. But I wonder what would happen if we could just simply step out of the present and just imagine what we do today. Everything, our thoughts, our words, our actions, and how that could have an impact right up into the year and even beyond the year 2145. Well, there's still people, again, like this idea of being the transitional generation. But many people often ask me, like, well, how do I heal from my intergenerational trauma when I don't even know my present family, let alone connect with my ancestors and those who have yet to be born? You know, they don't have any, let's say, family roots that they can recall. How do they know? And the answer is actually quite simple. It's in any kind of religious or social ceremonies or rituals always bring us back into a spiritual, a psychological, emotional, and a physical alignment or awareness with God and ourselves and all of our relations. And no matter what nationality or race or ethnicity or region we come from, every culture has these unique celebrations, whether they are religious or civil. And many ceremonies mark transitions in our lives, such as, say, graduations or weddings and funerals. And others may be more seasonal and follow a yearly observance, such as birthdays or anniversaries, holidays, solstice celebrations, etc. And regardless of when a particular ceremony is observed or whether or not a people are connected to their community, there's always this universal teaching, often hidden within the rituals themselves, that can be applied to all of humanity. And here's a great example. I read a definition one time from Mel Madrona around 2010, and he had just a classic definition of just the impact of rituals in our lives. And he puts it in the context of religion. And he says, the purpose of religion should be to help us maintain a binding commitment to spiritual awareness within the lives of our community. And he says, this is done through the power of rituals, which is this materialization of religion and the bearer of religious tradition and the ensurer of continuity of the life of the present with the original spirit of the past. And he says, this reenactment of traditional ritual and worship provided by religion ensures that the past or our ancestors continue to touch our souls in the very present. And one way in which his definition was really brought home to me was in a small village of Picaris Pueblo in New Mexico. And the ritual or the ceremony, I should say, that I'm thinking of occurs every August 10th in the village of Picaris. And this is when that community holds their harvest festival. And during the celebration, there are endless ceremonies commemorating the connection that people have with God, the creator and sustainer of life, the abundance from the land, and the love of their community and the love for each other. Well, all day long, there are religious services and foot races and indigenous drumming and singing and dances, and of course, sharing meals together. Well, the first time I attended this celebration, I was told about it many times, but the first time I attended, I was struck by looking at a large 25 to 30 foot wooden pole erected in the middle of town. And on top of this pole were tied three things: a sheep's carcass, a blanket, and a watermelon. And the elders explained to me that these items symbolize God's provision of food, clothing, and a connection to the land. And as the festival went on all day long, it really didn't come to, you know, the main point until later that afternoon, where you had these dancer clowns dressed in black and white, and they would come out and they would try to retrieve these items. And apart from reminding the people of importance of laughter and play as they worked their way through the crowds, it was the main responsibility of these clowns to climb that pole and recover these items. Well, in good comic fashion, the clowns would make several valiant efforts to climb the pole. And they would be swinging from the ropes, and they would try to stand on each other's shoulders, and they would be sliding down, much to the amusement and encouragement of the crowd. And finally, after several attempts, one clown would reach the top as cheers erupted from the crowd below. And one by one, the items would be lowered and received with joy. And as I sat there watching this, I was reminded of the teaching that surrounded this ceremony, that unless the clowns retrieved these items each year, the people would die. And initially, I thought this teaching was strange. After all, the community can't be expected to live off exclusively from, you know, live off a watermelon, a sheep, and a blanket. But then the meaning of the ceremony finally hit me, that any failure to retrieve these items was not meant to be taken as a literal death, but rather it symbolized what dies within the people as they live is what truly matters the most. What dies within the people as they live is the most important thing. See, apart from food and clothing and shelter, the real issues that we cannot afford to live without are hope and love and gratitude, inner peace, and grace. These virtues are the true life-giving gifts that nourish and sustain the soul that far exceeds material possessions. Because these ceremonies and rituals contain deeper levels of meaning, and succeeding generations need to learn the relevance that ceremonies have for them to live in their awareness that they too are souls. And by doing so, nothing is taken for granted in this life. Not one breath, not one sip of water, nor one opportunity to bring healing from trauma in another person's life. Everything and everyone is connected. Well, we're about halfway through the show, but I would really love to hear your heart on these matters. So again, if you'd like to call in, that number is 888-627-6008. And I will be taking your calls after the break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I am your host, Dr. James Houck, and I will be back with you in 1 minute. Okay, welcome back. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you're listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Again, I just want to share with you a little bit about next week's show, October 23rd, and that is entitled Stepping on the Sacred Path. Now, again, many people often get this image in their minds that a spiritual path is this little foot trail where we, if we're not careful, we could easily step off that path, or we trip and we fall down or something. But I would like to propose that what if the spiritual path is this journey in which it doesn't matter where we place our steps, because we're always walking the right road. When, you know, we don't live in this fear of, am I going to step off the path at any given moment? But wherever our feet touch, that's the path in which we are to follow. So that's next week. Tune in next Friday, noon Pacific Standard Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Well, earlier in the show, we were talking about the creating a living dialogue with our ancestors, you know, not just those who have come before us, but also those who will come after us. And can we truly see everyone whom we are connected to? And just like my teacher said to me many, many years ago, he said, you know, do you see all of the generations of those who have come before you in, you know, whose blood, your blood, carries the DNA of their lives and yours? And this goes way beyond just every characteristic of genes, but he also encouraged me to also see their personalities, character strengths, flaws, struggles, fears, triumphs, joys, mistakes. And he said, can you see their souls when they took their very first breath? Can you see them before what we call time? That a time when the Creator dreamt them. And a time when the Creator dreamt you. And he said, once you can see those who have come before you like this, you will also be able to see those who will come after you, those who are alive but are yet to be born, because they are all there in that single drop of blood. And this really opened up further understanding regarding living out these truths of reaching out to one another in love and the impact of our lives and every thought, every word, every deed has that impact up to seven generations. And these days, obtaining ancestral information is certainly made easier with the assistance of online searches, and many people just have fun with it. And in my own interest in working with intergenerational trauma and ancestral healing, I encourage people to work with three, maybe four generations to start with and just imagine what their lives were like. And, ideally, going back seven generations creates a more thorough context, excuse me, for healing to occur, because it is based on the seventh generational principle that originates from the Native American Iroquois Nation. And this principle taught that every decision, albeit on an individual basis or societal, must consider the impact up to the seventh generation. And it states, the thickness of your skin shall be seven spans, which is to say that you shall be proof against your anger, offensive actions and criticism. Your heart shall be filled with peace and goodwill, and your mind filled with a yearning for the welfare of all the people. With endless patience, you shall carry out your duty, and your firmness shall be tempered with tenderness for your people. Neither anger nor fury shall find lodging in your mind, and all your words and actions shall be marked with calm deliberation. And in all your deliberations, in the council of people, in your efforts at lawmaking and all your official acts, self-interest shall be cast into an oblivion. But cast not over your shoulder behind you the warnings of the nephews and nieces, should they chide you for any error or wrong you may do, but return to the way of the great law, which is just and right. Therefore, look and listen to the welfare of the whole people, and have always in your view not only the present, but also the coming generations, even those whose faces are yet beneath the surface of the ground, the unborn future of a people. And although this principle emphasizes the effect present decisions have on seven generations into the future, I believe it also provides us a social context to be able to heal seven generations before us whose decisions are affecting us today. So let's throw out another example here that every new generation begins with approximately between 25 and 30 years, okay, for the sake of argument. And this means that the seventh generation of our ancestors would have begun approximately 175, 210, give or take a year or two, years ago. And let's say that, again, if a person was born in 1980, his or her ancestral context map would kind of look like this, that the first generation was born somewhere around 1950, 1955 with their parents. The second generation going back 1930, 1920, the great-grandparents. Third generation going back somewhere 1905 to 1890 with great-great-grandparents. And then the fourth generation, 1880 to 1860, somewhere thereabouts. Fifth generation, 1855, 1830. Sixth generation, 1830 to 1800. And then the seventh generation comes in somewhere around 1770 to about 1805. And that is going back seven generations. And I wonder if the people who lived back then knew that the decisions that they made, even the words that they spoke and the tone that they spoke to each other, would have this impact of what we're dealing with today in the 21st century. Well, it's an interesting concept, something that is certainly fascinating to say the least, but it does bring home this understanding of how we are to reach out to one another because we are so connected with one another. And one of the things that I have learned is that soul healing and release of these souls that I spoke about last week is not just the work of a select few people, but everyone, I believe, has the potential to heal their own ancestral relationships. And I meet so many people who want to stop the cycle of intergenerational trauma, but they are just at a loss as to what they can do next. And nevertheless, the best place to begin this journey toward healing is to first examine, you know, their own symptoms and situations in life, problems that they struggle with with time and time again that they just can't get a handle on, but still not to let those things to be the excuse of why they think they cannot reach out to others. And for me, what began on a mass scale of releasing land and souls held by intergenerational trauma all started at Montauk on Long Island. And again, this was a story that I had shared last week. Invite you, if you missed the show, to go back and listen to the archive because this is how I would say it all got started for me. Something that I wasn't taught, but again, what was awakened in me was something that I had to come into that understanding and that realization. Began for me on, let's say, a larger scale, I also had shifted in performing, let's say, the soul and land clearing on an individual basis, working with my family of origin. See, in my life, it was a struggle with anxiety. But as I probed deeper, I became aware of my own unconscious fear of being trapped and suffocating. didn't really have, a good sense of just being in crowds. I wasn't claustrophobic, but still, it was just underlying anxiety. I just couldn't put my finger on at times. And for example, for months, I knew that I had to return to an abandoned mine where over 40 plus coal miners were killed in a horrific gas explosion. And this was also the place where my grandfather had died from a falling rock as he was mining some 12 years later. And my father, he himself was only 2 years old at the time, and he grew up without a father. And as I was growing up, my father never liked to talk about this story, so I had to do the research on my own and just to figure out what was going on and what exactly happened here. And it's in a little coal mining town called Clymer, Pennsylvania. And it happened, I believe it was in 1922, but don't hold me to it because I'm going on memory. So somewhere thereabouts, 1922. And it is just amazing just how the number of people who lived in adjoining towns just came out because all these little coal mining towns were connected with not just coal mining, but tragedy. And so whenever there was a cave-in or an explosion and bodies were trapped, everybody came out to help. And this was the case of the explosion that killed 40-plus coal miners 12 years before my grandfather went to work in the mine. And I can't imagine what that conversation must have been like for my grandfather with his father, my great-grandfather. Or great-great-grandfather, there we go, just saying that, I want to become a coal miner and I want to go back into the very mine that had an explosion and killed over 40 miners. And I don't think his father would have been pleased with that decision because his father was a businessman and he could have surely gone into the family business. But my grandfather, he decided to go into the mines instead. And just what, let's say, his own mother felt about that. How did she feel? Did she feel betrayed at all? Did she worry every day? Did she pray for him every day? And then when he met my grandmother and, them starting a life together, they were, by all standards, kids. If we want to look at it today, he died when he was about 22, 23 years old. And, my grandmother was very close to his age as well. But here she was with a 2-year-old at the time and widowed in her early 20s. And it's just imagining the heartbreak that caused in the family and the pain and just not knowing of, well, how do we live now? What do we do? How do we survive? Or is this something that's going to hang over our heads for generations after generations after generations? And I knew I had to go back and visit this cave. It was something that just kept calling me and calling me and calling me. Just something that I just needed to not just see for myself, but I really wanted to offer my own healing to the men, the women, the families of everybody who was affected by this coal mining explosion. And so I decided on the day and time I would be out there. And when I stood at the mouth of the now demolished mine entrance, I often take my drum and my Native American drum and flute and so forth. And I sat there and I drummed quietly and I offered tobacco prayer ties for these men and their families and the surrounding town. And I felt such a heaviness. I felt that traumatic pain that the land was still holding on to, as well as the emotional burdens that the generations of families from other coal mine accidents carried for so long. It was just something that these towns had in common. They all had stories. They all had monuments erected to this happened way back when. And on the anniversary of those accidents, there's a solemnness in the town. The solemnness, not just, you know, felt by the old timers, but even the younger generations are reminded of, well, this is who we are. This is what happened to us collectively. And in addition to feeling all this, I was also seeking healing for myself. And little did I realize that there's going to be healing for many, many others. So again, as I stood at the mouth of this abandoned coal mine entrance, I just drummed a little bit and I just quietly prayed. And I asked for forgiveness, you know, for myself, and because I was very bitter at the time, and I had very strong negative emotions that I harbored in my soul against my grandfather and my father. And I just, like I said, I didn't realize the story. I didn't understand the story, and I could never put my finger on it, why the men in the family just seemed so distant, just seemed so caught up with anxiety and the fear of the future. But understanding what happened and what they lived through and how they lived through it, you know, those little coal mining towns didn't like to put a whole lot of stock in the future, because every day you didn't know whether or not you're going to come out of the mines. It wasn't a matter of if, it was a matter of when. Sooner or later, there would be an explosion. But the question was just how bad was it going to be? And could you make it out? And could you make it home? Well, in that moment, as I was asking for forgiveness because of the bitterness I harbored against my grandfather and my father, I realized that perhaps my father was simply incapable of meeting my emotional needs as a parent, because his father was not there to meet his emotional needs. And his father's death may have also contributed significantly to my father being very quiet, or very reserved, and a very anxious man. In fact, I remember that all his life, my father struggled with the attitude that there was or is something that could always go wrong. And he could never put his finger on it, but he always felt this free-floating anxiety of impending doom. Where, oh yes, he smiled and he laughed and he, you know, celebrated from time to time. He was just very low-key about it. This is almost as if he cautioned himself against having a good time, against, well, we don't want to celebrate too much because, you know, tomorrow, you know, we just don't know. Where I'm of the opinion, it's like, hey, let's celebrate, you know, mightily today because of tomorrow. We simply don't know. So let's celebrate the good times. Let's be filled with joy, and let's care for one another, because life is a mixture often at times of joy and pain or sorrow, but yet celebration. Okay. Well, I also asked for forgiveness for the negativity and the bitterness I was holding on to regarding the effect this trauma had on my family, as well as the fact that nobody really talked to me about this trauma as a child. Like I said, just it was never shared. The story was never shared, even though it was like, yeah, it was something happened and that's how your grandfather died. But perhaps, you know, the family was often too overwhelmed to put into words their memories of that day because they were stuck in their own trauma. Well, furthermore, I also thanked my grandfather for his hard work and his sacrifice. Perhaps he didn't have a choice but to work in the mine. And like I said, I don't know what that conversation he had with his parents, what that looked like or sounded like, or, you know, I can't imagine, you know, going back into a mine that had, you know, been known for explosions and a large number of miners were killed. But then again, coal mining was the mainstay of the communities back then. And perhaps his own mother and father struggled with their own emotional pain. And knowing that their son was going back to work at this very same place. And this mine definitely had a reputation, as all mines did in the western part of Pennsylvania. Well, nonetheless, I thanked him for his dedication, especially when his body ached and the times that he didn't feel like going to work. And I imagine him coming home each night to his family, scrubbing up before dinner and washing the cold dirt, going down the drain, being rinsed from his hands and his body. And I thanked him for that. I thanked him for making these sacrifices. And I thanked him for what he did day in and day out, because people like him and others working in these mines provided for and sustained the economic energy at that time. And when I was finished, I said that I loved him, that even though I never met him, and that I was honored to be his grandson. And although not a coal miner myself, I could sense the metaphorical coal dust in my veins. And I laughed to myself when I was reminded of the times that as a boy, I would always dig in the dirt and returned home and was ordered by my mother to take a bath before dinner. And she would say things like, you take those shoes off and you go straight to the bath and you wash yourself and you will not eat dinner until you are clean. And, perhaps I got it from somewhere, who knows, but nonetheless. Well, when I finished drumming and praying, I saw my grandfather come up out of the mouth of the mine, and he was dressed in his work clothes and his helmet, and he was covered in soot and holding his lunch pail. And as I caught a glimpse of him, he immediately was taken up into heaven, just a whoosh. I didn't hear the whoosh, but that's if we would give it sound, I'm sure that's what it sounded like. He was just here and then gone. And to my surprise, other coal miners followed. One by one, those who had died in other mines were being released as well. They climbed out. They brushed off the excess soot from their bodies and the coal dust and everything else, and then they were whisked away to heaven. And to me, it seemed as though hundreds of these souls, perhaps other from other coal mining accidents, came up out of this portal. And my soul just swelled with joy as I sat there quietly watching these men being transported to heaven one by one. Just whoosh, there they would go. And sometimes I would resume drumming softly, and once the last coal miner was transported to heaven, I just sensed wave after wave after wave of an incredible peace just washing over me. And I do indeed realize that in that moment, the traumatic energy of the land had indeed shifted. And I breathed in a freshness of love and life and light. And interestingly, as I was driving back home on the highway, sipping my coffee and trying to just take in everything that had taken place, all of a sudden, this image just flashed before my eyes, and I think I had shared once before with this audience that I had to actually pull over, that I saw my grandfather still dressed in his work clothes, and my father as an adult standing arm in arm, smiling and laughing, reunited once again. And I too smiled, and I go, imagine that, grandfather, father, son. And I pass that on to my son. Well, it's true that life can be filled with many tragedies, heartbreak, and pain, but there are also times of celebration and joy. Never let life kill the dream in you, but also keep in mind it's what dies within us as we live is what we have to pay attention to the most. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you've been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. I invite you to tune in next week, and where we will explore some more integration of spirituality and mental health. But in the meantime, please be safe, and I will see you all back here next week. Take care. Bye-bye.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding to buy a book by Dr. Houck, it's all there. Just wander on over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Friday at noon Pacific Time on PBS Radio TV.